From WBUR Boston, I'm Charles Sennett, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the Senate floor last week, Senator John McCain introduced an amendment to prohibit the cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of prisoners held abroad by the U.S. military. It passed by an overwhelming majority. The final vote, 90-9. Here was a Republican, a staunch supporter of the war in Iraq, drawing a moral line on the post-9/11 gloves-off interrogation techniques. Those techniques yielded the haunting and damning imagery from Abu Ghraib. They are techniques that, according to McCain, result in bad intelligence, danger to our troops, and a hobbling of our own moral standing in the world war of ideas. The White House helped defeat nearly the same amendment in July, and it's still threatening a veto. But political winds of change have blown through Washington this fall, and the acrid smell of prisoner abuse still hangs in the air. This hour, On Point, we're talking about the fine line in the war on terror between security and human rights, and how that line is being drawn in Washington. We'll start with Senator McCain, a Republican from Arizona, on the floor of the Senate last Thursday. McCain, himself tortured as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, explained why he proposed an amendment on detainee treatment to the Department of Defense Appropriations Bill.
Mr. President, I travel a lot around the world, usually at taxpayers' expense, and everywhere I go, I encounter this issue of the treatment of prisoners and the photos of Abu Ghraib and what is perceived to be in the world to be continued mistreatment of prisoners. It is harming our image in the world terribly. We have got to clarify that that is not what the United States is all about. That's what makes us different. That's what makes us different from the enemy we are fighting. And, Mr. President, the most important thing about it is not our image abroad, but our respect for ourselves at home.
That's Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, speaking last Thursday and bringing his moral weight to this issue. Joining me now from Washington is Eric Schmidt, who covers the Pentagon for the New York Times. He's been following the detainee treatment amendment sponsored by McCain. Eric, welcome.
Hi, Charles. How are you today?
Great. This issue, it seems to have resurfaced. It's as if these dark images of Abu Ghraib keep coming back at us, but this is actually not the first time that McCain introduced this amendment. He did it over the summer. Why did it pass now, and why with such an overwhelming majority?
Well, what happened was Senator McCain tried to bring this up earlier this summer, as you pointed out, on the Defense Authorization Bill. This is essentially the budget bill for the Pentagon. The Majority Leader Bill Frist pulled that bill down after it became clear that there were going to be several other amendments, and this was going to take up a lot of time on the Senate floor during a period where the Republican leadership wanted other bills to come up for vote. So it got yanked down, but it was resurrected, just as you said, last week on the defense spending bill. This is the appropriations bill that actually is the essential bill for the military in funding all operations there. So McCain was successful in attaching this as an amendment to that bill, a must-pass bill for the military. And again, he, as you said, went to the floor of the Senate and made an impassioned plea. He already had several Republican co-sponsors, people like John Warner, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Lindsey Graham, Susan Collins. So he had a number of other Republicans on his side. And despite a threatened veto from the White House, once the momentum behind this grew, it became clear that there weren't a lot of Republicans who wanted to stand in the way of being perceived as against voting against a measure that condemned torture.
Why do you think McCain chose this moment to bring this out and to really push this law? It seems like not only did he have overwhelming support, but he also seems to have seized upon a moment in the Bush administration's journey in which they're somewhat weakened, and it seems to be a window of opportunity for him to push this through. Is this a new kind of view of the Bush administration in which they're not keeping the same discipline and order?
Yes, I would say there are three things working here. One, we just talked about the procedural avenue was open for McCain to bring this up again. Two, there were some new reports just in the last few weeks aired by some former members of the 82nd Airborne Division about some prisoner abuses at a holding facility they were at in Iraq, roughly around the same time as Abu Ghraib. So it was, the issue was back in the news again. And then, as you say, McCain and his allies were confronting an administration and a White House and a president who's been weakened badly by everything from the economy to the handling of Katrina to the war in Iraq overall, and with the loss of people, at least temporarily, in the House of Tom DeLays and one of his enforcers there, the cloud hanging over Senator Frist in the Senate, the White House's ability to maintain discipline within its ranks in the Senate has been weakened. And I think you have the combination of all these things. And once it became clear that this amendment was going to pass, because all the Democrats, of course, were going to vote for it, you had essentially what was a stampede for many people who may have, many Republicans who may have been sitting on the fence, rushing to get over on what they consider kind of the right side of this issue, if you will.
So there's a great political backdrop to this issue, but where does it go next? Where do we see it go?
What happens now is it goes to a House-Senate conference committee. The House has already passed its version of the spending bill, but without any of this language, and frankly, the measure on its own merits would face a much tougher stance over in the House, which is where there is still a little bit more discipline in adhering to the administration's threat that they did not want this measure to come up. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Obviously, the size of the vote that you alluded to, 90-9, in McCain's eloquence on this issue as a former POW, will carry a lot of weight, even though he's not a member of the Appropriations Committee. There are some powerful members in the House, particularly on the Democratic side. John Murtha, former Marine, has come out in strong support of this. Question will be, will there be Republicans on the House side that will go to bat for this in the committee? But we'll know probably fairly soon, the next few weeks.
So would you say likely to be defeated in the House?
Well, again, it's a conference committee, so they get together in the House and Senate members get together and they reconcile the differences in their two bills. So the question is, will it be reconciled within this conference committee? If it's included in the conference report, this is kind of a take it or leave it. You don't amend conference reports on the floor. So
okay.
if the members of this conference report agree on this, and there's suggestions that could happen, then it would very likely pass because it's part of this larger bill that must pass and that all members would vote for almost.
Okay, Eric, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Charles.
It's Eric Schmidt of the New York Times from Washington, and we're talking this hour about the fine line in the war on terror between security and human rights. You can join the conversation. What do you feel is the line between rough interrogation and torture? Should the military be given wide latitude in its treatment of prisoners? What if it can save lives? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Concord, New Hampshire, is John Hudson, president and dean of Franklin Pierce Law Center. He is the former judge advocate general in the U.S. Navy. And joining me as well from Oxford, Pennsylvania, is Mark Bowden. He's a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and author of Black Hawk Down. He's written extensively about interrogation. First, let's go to you, John Hudson. Can you tell us a little bit about your view of the McCain Amendment? Why do you support this?
Well, I think it's absolutely necessary. I would add one item to Eric's list of reasons why it was now, which is that there's been a long passage of time in which really nothing has happened. We've paid a certain amount of lip service to human rights and the rule of law, but nobody had really done anything to ensure it or enforce it. So that I think Senator McCain just watched nothing happen for a long, long time and decided that now was the propitious time for him to do something, and he did. And I applaud it. I think it's exactly what the United States Senate is supposed to be doing in its sense, its responsibilities for oversight of the armed forces.
Okay, and you've written a strong letter in support of this legislation. Is that right?
I have, along with two dozen other admirals and generals, and three or four former prisoners of war.
Okay, I want to turn now to Mark Bowden, and I want to talk to Mark a little bit about a piece that he wrote in the Atlantic Monthly, which was a eloquent but very dark journey into this world of interrogation, and you were trying to flesh out for us how we need to put this in the context of someone with boots on the ground, what it's like to be making these hard decisions, not on the Senate floor, but in an interrogation room in Iraq. Mark, what do you think of this legislation?
I think it's a good thing. I wrote in that piece that I felt that it was important that all forms of coercion and interrogation be banned. But I have to wonder, you know, how, and I'd actually be interested in hearing what John has to say about this, how likely it is to change much on a practical level, because, as I'm sure John knows, the Army field manuals currently ban all forms of coercion and interrogation, and our international agreements do the same. I think that what has to happen is that the executive branch and the military itself has to become more aggressive in making sure this kind of thing doesn't get out of hand.
Okay, Mark, when we come back, I want to talk to you specifically about the manuals and about your point of view that the military does need some latitude, even though that manual becomes the gold standard. We're talking this hour about the fine line in the war on terror between interrogation and torture and how that line's being drawn in Washington. You can join the conversation. Should the military be given wide latitude in its treatment of prisoners? What if it can save lives? Where is your line between interrogation and torture? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Charles Sennett, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Charlie Sennett, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the fine line in the war on terror between interrogation and torture, between security and human rights, and how that line is being drawn in Washington. You can join the conversation. What do the reports of torture and abuse do to America's reputation, its own psyche, not to mention what it does to the abused prisoners? Are rough interrogation methods effective for gathering information? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Concord, New Hampshire is John Hudson, President and Dean of Franklin Pierce Law Center. He's also the former Judge Advocate General in the U.S. Navy. And we're also joined by Mark Bowden from Oxford, Pennsylvania. He's national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and author of Black Hawk Down. He's written extensively about interrogation. I want to turn first to you, John Hudson, and bring back Mark Bowden's question, which is, will this change anything? Will the McCain Amendment and a attempt to kind of codify these guidelines change anything on the ground?
Well, we can only hope so. Mark is absolutely right that the laws and regulations are on the books right now. I mean, you know, Article 93 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice prohibits cruelty and maltreatment of subordinates so that people can be court-martialed for the kinds of things that we have seen happen. What the amendment does, though, I think, and particularly since it was so resoundingly passed, is make it abundantly clear that at least the United States Senate feels very strongly about this. Now we've got to get the House of Representatives and significantly the Commander-in-Chief to demonstrate the same support of it. But this is a significantly different thing than having Scott McClellan at some press conference say, oh yeah, we don't support torture. You know, this is doing it the right way. So I think that if it passes and gets through a veto or avoids a veto, then we will have made the kind of clarion statement that I think we needed to have made a long, long time ago.
But, I mean, you're talking about the moral argument still, which is clear. What we're really asking is more along the lines of the practical realm. Will this change anything on the ground?
I think that it will, because the great strength of the United States Armed Forces is now and always has been the chain of command. And that what goes down the chain of command drops like a rock from you know the top, from the Commander-in-Chief and the Secretary of Defense, down to the Lindy England and Greniers and Fredericks of the world, so that if the United States, at the very highest level, makes a clear, unmistakable statement, unambiguous in every respect, that we won't do this, then the generals will figure it out, and then the colonels will figure it out, and the majors and the captains and the sergeants, and it will stop. Mm-hmm. But up to now, that hasn't happened, unfortunately, and I'm not exactly sure why it hasn't happened up to now, but it hasn't. So this is a big step, I think, in that direction.
Well, it hasn't happened, and also it appears the abuse is continuing, at least based on the testimony from Captain Fishback.
Right.
Who's been one of the key figures
right.
supplying information to McCain. So it seems that this is very much a pattern of confusion in which the soldiers on the ground don't understand what are the guidelines for them to follow. So I want to shift the conversation to Mark Bowden, who has written about precisely that, the nitty-gritty details of military interrogation methods. And he's very much explored the line between coercion and abuse, rough interrogation and torture. Mark, bring us inside an interrogation room. You interviewed many people who do these interrogations, and talk to us about these issues in the way they play out in reality on the ground in Iraq or in Afghanistan.
Well, my understanding, Charles, is that it's kind of a myth that we don't do that. As we heard John McCain say earlier that, you know, he was moved by the belief that, you know, the American military doesn't engage in the kind of horrific practices that other countries and other nations have throughout history. And I don't believe that's true. I think that in my experience, since for talking to soldiers, abuses are common. In fact, to use, you know, a computer metaphor, I would say that we have to assume that abuse is the default position. It occurs in every prison, not just in military prisons, but I think the temptation to abuse prisoners is even greater in a military prison where you have guards who are separated by culture, by the animosity of a war, by the feeling that the people they're guarding, you know, might do them harm if they had an opportunity. I mean, the whole situation of a military prison is just set up for abuse. And so unless there's a really strong institutional commitment and safeguard to policing soldiers, I think you're always going to have and always have had cases of serious abuse. That's a separate issue, Charles, from mm-hmm. the question of whether or not it's ever appropriate to use coercive tactics against individual prisoners. And I think that in some cases it is.
All right. Give us one of those cases. Take us right into some of the real-time examples that you were able to draw out from the people who you interviewed, both Israeli interrogators, U.S. interrogators, and the sense they had that if they can save lives, they may use rough interrogation. And it was very, I thought, controversial in the way in which you put that forward. I want to hear your explanation based on what you've heard from your sources on that.
The point I was trying to make is that this would be a very simple issue from a moral standpoint if coercion didn't work, if any form of coercive tactic just produced false testimony and was essentially worthless. I think everybody could, you know, very readily line up behind what works. I think that, you know, we all want good intelligence. There's no doubt that that coercion does produce and can produce rapid and good information. I used a number of examples. One, which had nothing to do with warfare, was a kidnapping case in Germany just last year where a kidnapper had taken a 12-year-old boy and buried him alive, and the police captured the kidnapper when he'd come to pick up his ransom, and he refused to tell them where he'd buried the child. So the police chief threatened him with torture. He didn't actually torture him, he just threatened him, and he promptly told the police where he had buried the child.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, Amnesty International wanted the police chief to be discipline for doing it, and in that case, I would respectfully disagree. In a war zone, and I used the example of an instance in Vietnam where I quoted a former Army captain who had a group of men who were being decimated by snipers in the swamps, and he caught one of the leaders of the Viet Cong snipers. He knew this man could tell him where the enemy was hiding, and where they were shooting. And to not get this information from the guy meant that he and his men were going to continue to be picked apart. So he felt compelled to get the information from the guy and actually, you know, threatened to torture him.
Right. I mean, kidnapping and Vietnam are two examples you have in your piece. I think the question is, does it work in the war on terror? Is there a qualitative difference between those men who see themselves as Islamic militants fighting a global jihad, who see themselves in a war against the West? They play by very different rules. And I wanted to hear from you, John Hudson, about your response. Is there any record or is there any research that would indicate that, yes, at times rough interrogation is necessary and that, in fact, it has worked?
Yeah, sure. The difference, though, is between the situations that Mark was quite correctly pointing to is that you've got a specific subject whom you know has information. What we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere is that we're just abusing everybody to find out if they have any information. And in that situation, the information that you do get, and you will get information, you have no reason to believe that it's valid, because people will tell you anything just to make you stop the pain. So that it's one thing to talk about arguably correctly, that in the case of the kidnapper, when you know that that's the individual who knows where the child is buried, as opposed to just picking somebody up in the desert in Iraq and torturing them to find out what he may or may not know.
So context is everything.
Context
here.
Is everything.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say that although I completely understand Mark's position on it, I think that if you say, well, if you really, 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 really need the information, then you can torture them, is a slippery slope. Hmm. I personally think you just have to have a rule, bright line, that says you can't torture people. If the prosecutor, if though in the ticking time bomb scenario or the buried child scenario, torture is engaged in to find the information, and the prosecutor decides not to prosecute, or the jury decides not to convict, or the president decides to grant a pardon, then the process has worked. But if you start dicing out when you can torture and when you may not, I think that's a problem.
Okay. Bright lines tend to get very dusty in the sands of Iraq. We have with us Nathaniel Fick, who we want to invite into the conversation. He's a former captain in the Marines' 1st Reconnaissance Battalion. He's served in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's also the author of One Bullet Away, The Making of a Marine Officer. Nathaniel, welcome.
Thanks, Charles.
I wanted to ask you, as someone who's been on the ground, you are a Marine. You were even, I believe, trained in some of the interrogation methods. Is that correct?
I was trained on the other side of the fence, actually, Charles. I went through a course called SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, that trains U.S. forces how to resist torture.
Okay. What was your sense on the ground in Iraq? Did you feel that sense of confusion on these guidelines, or did you feel that the military manuals were quite clear and you knew where to go with this as a leader of your unit?
I thought I had pretty good guidance, and I should make clear, I was not the one in the interrogation room. I was the one out on the ground picking up prisoners who mm-hmm. would then maybe end up in the military prison system. But at that point of contact, when you have a group of young Americans and a group of young Iraqis or Syrians, Saudis, you have to remember these people have been shooting at one another maybe just seconds before, and tension is so high that the guidelines have to be absolutely clear, and the leadership has to be absolutely resolute in order to keep abuse from happening.
When you are on the ground and you are picking up a detainee, that can be full of emotion. I mean, this detainee could have been shooting at you just minutes before. You may have been in a situation where you've got the red-hot anger of a war zone among your men. Did you ever see anyone go over the line or do something you found inappropriate or outside of those manuals that you'd be concerned about, even in that preliminary phase before you get to interrogation?
I did, and I think it's incumbent on leadership at a very junior level to nip it in the bud. My guiding principles were given to me when I was in my training, and they were three. It was be ready always, win every time, and return your Marines to society better than they were when you got them. And that last one, to me, means you have to get people back to their lives, not only physically intact, but psychologically intact. And when Senator McCain on the Senate floor said that this is about more than the Iraqi prisoners, this is about Americans, I think that's what he was referring to.
I think that's a very interesting point, because this kind of abuse, when it gets out of control, not only damages the body and the soul of the detainee or the prisoners being abused, but it also affects the psyche of the soldier on the ground, the interrogator in that room, and even in a larger sense, our own country. John Hudson, come back to these points and tell us a little bit about what you would say to Nathaniel Fick's men when they're crossing that kind of line. How would you want to speak to them about moral authority in this equation?
Well, I think Nathaniel's absolutely right in his three prongs. And the great strength that the United States has, I believe, the reason we're the strongest country in the world is not because of our military might or the essential island nature of our geography or our economy. It is our mission. It is what we have stood for 225 years. And if we give that up, if our soldiers on the ground give that up, then we will have essentially lost. And, you know, that would be obviously the greatest tragedy of all. You know, what's the point of fighting? So that I think Mark was right earlier when he said that, you know, that human, the unfortunate human nature, the dark side of all of us that we never want to talk about might lead people under those kinds of conditions to fall prey to those temptations. And it takes the leadership that Nathaniel is talking about from the junior officers, senior NCOs, the junior officers, and right up the chain of command, mm-hmm. to draw that bright line and say, we will not do this. And the great thing about the American fighting men and women is if you give them those kind of guidelines, they will, for the most part, follow them.
Okay, John, thank you. We're gonna take that point, and we're going to try to turn it over to some callers now as well. We're talking in this hour on Point about the fine line, the war on terror. I'm Charles Sennett, and this is On Point. And you can join the conversation. Right now, we're going to bring in Joel, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hello, Joel.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on air. What's your question?
Well, I don't have a question so much as I have a comment. I have listened with interest to the other callers and speakers, and I agree with what I hear most of them saying. I was an officer in the United States Army JAG Corps in Vietnam, and I had the obligation of teaching the law of warfare to the soldiers of the AmeriCal Division. That was the 23rd Infantry Division, known as the AmeriCal, where the My Lai massacre had occurred. And I saw the great need for there to be a very clear, bright line definition of what the law of warfare was, and to teach our soldiers what that was. And after Vietnam, I had the opportunity to teach law at West Point, and I taught international law. And we made a very big effort to instill in the cadets of West Point what the law is and ought to be. And no law is going to prevent violations of that law from occurring. Mm-hmm. We have laws against rape. Do they prevent all rapes? Of course not.
Right.
But we know who we are, and we know what America stands for, and we stand for following our obligations as set forth under the Geneva Convention.
So what do you think of the McCain Amendment then, Joel?
I support it.
Okay.
And I'm proud to see the generals and admirals that were mentioned a while ago, these former judge advocates, general of the Army and Navy, signing on and giving their support. I think that's very admirable of them. I'm proud of them.
Okay. Thank you, Joel. That's an excellent point, and it's one of the things that's really revealing itself in this debate is the feeling among military officers, brass, and soldiers on the ground that there is a need for clarity here. We're talking this hour about the fine line in the war on terror between security and human rights. You can join the conversation. Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Charles Sennett, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services, in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Charles Sennett, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the fine line in the war on terror, how those lines are observed and sometimes obscured in the deserts of Iraq and the dusts of Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. How are the continuing reports of detainee treatment and prisoner abuse affecting the American war on terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from Concord, New Hampshire, with John Hudson, President and Dean of Franklin Pierce Law Center. He's the former Judge Advocate General in the U.S. Navy. And also joining us from Oxford, Pennsylvania, is Mark Bowden. He's National Correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and author of Black Hawk Down. We also have on the line Nathaniel Fick, who is a former captain in the Marines 1st Reconnaissance Battalion. He's served in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he's written a new book, One Bullet Away. I want to go first to some callers, and then I want to quickly bring in our guest to comment on this. We have a caller, Donna, from Mount Vernon, Virginia. Donna, go ahead.
Well, hi.
Hi.
What I was thinking about as I listened is the fact that it's important that you have very good people in your leadership positions, people who have dealt with situations before and know how to act mm-hmm. and react.
Have you ever been in that situation, Donna? Are you in the military or in law enforcement?
Fortunately, God knows, I have not been in that situation, but I have worked in law enforcement, and
okay.
there comes a time when you do have to investigate. I don't want to upset anyone, but I do believe in torture, physical and mental, but as a last resort. And it's only if there is a dire situation. If it's a small situation, what would you need to go all that way for?
Okay. All right. Donna, thank you. So Donna is talking about her experiences, even from perhaps the fringes of law enforcement, but looking at this issue of how do you get information when you're dealing with something as dramatic as a child hostage situation, something as chilling as the war in Vietnam, or something as real and right now as the war in Iraq and the threat of terrorism that the United States is facing. Mark, she seems to be expressing kind of the core element of what you are arguing for, which is latitude in certain specific circumstances.
Well, actually, Charles, I don't argue for latitude. I think, and
okay.
I wrote it in the article, and I've tried to make it very clear, that the only way that you prevent widespread abuse is to ban all forms of torture and coercion and to actively prosecute those who violate the law, which I don't think has been going on quite as much as needs happen in the Bush administration. But having said that, I do agree with Donna, and I think John has expressed his agreement, that there are specific instances, and these are generally fairly rare cases, where it is, I think, morally imperative to coerce information from someone. And I use the word coerce because I think that it's more effective. Some of the techniques that I described in the article are more effective than outright physical torture. But in taking that step, in using coercion, the interrogator must be violating the law and must be exposing himself or herself to possible punishment and prosecution for violating the law. I think that's the only way that you prevent the kind of widespread abuse that we've seen.
Okay. I want to turn back to another caller. We have Robin, who is calling from Irmo, South Carolina. Robin, go ahead. What's your question?
Thank you. I'd like to give a perspective as a woman and get a reaction from your experts. It seems to me that the official approach of the Bush administration in dealing with the Abu Ghraib scandal has been to scapegoat some of the female soldiers as an example, the little London girl who is supposedly minimally competent has taken a great deal of the blame, and certainly she's paying for her participation. General Karpinski as well has suffered a lot of blame for this, and the things that I have read about her lead me to believe that she was not so culpable, whereas the upper male hierarchy have accepted almost no culpability.
Hmm. All right.
So that's a point that I wanted to have them react to, and I do support and applaud the McCain Amendment.
That's an interesting point, Robin. I think you were referring there to Lindy England, and I want to ask Nathaniel Fick about that. I want to talk about that. Is this some level of scapegoating? Are we seeing someone who is on the ground being blamed for what may be, in fact, more of a systemic error?
I think there was certainly scapegoating at Abu Ghraib. I don't believe it was along gender lines. I think that the junior enlisted soldiers bore a disproportionate burden of punishment. Certainly they're responsible, Lindy England and Charles Grainer and the others who were there in the photographs. But commands set a climate. And my question during that trial was, where were the lieutenants and the captains, the majors and the colonels in that chain of command between Lindy England and General Karpinski? I think it really does illustrate a point now, though, that we have something called the strategic corporal, the idea that the ever-present media and our destructive weaponry can put decisions with national, political, strategic consequences on the shoulders of junior soldiers or Marines.
Okay. I want to also go to another caller. David is calling from Chevy Chase, Maryland. David, welcome.
Yes, thank you. My question has to do with the large number of contractors that are operating in Iraq. What kind of training do they have? What laws are they operating under? Who is monitoring their behavior? And what do we actually know about how they are treating detainees?
David, that's an excellent question. I think everyone is wondering about what has come to be known as sort of the outsourcing of torture, both by private contractors and possibly even in some instances by other states. So let's go to John Hudson. Maybe you can help bring us inside that world and try to answer David's question.
David has an excellent question and makes a strong point. You know, there are 30 or 50,000 contractors there, many of whom are doing what have heretofore been essential military functions, and many of them aren't even American citizens. So that the jurisdiction over them for their misdeeds is very tenuous.
Do you think that was intentional by the administration to create some form of wiggle room within these guidelines?
Boy, I'll tell you, Charlie, I have a heart. I certainly don't want to think that.
Well, why would they outsource that?
I think that what has happened, and I do firmly believe, is that we're trying to keep the number of U.S. troops down and into artificially low levels so that you've got 135,000 or 140,000 troops doing what 200,000 troops ought to be doing, and that the delta between those two numbers is being made up largely by contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And so that when you look at the number of troops there, it doesn't look like it's as big a force as it really is. Now, whether I would hate to take that next step and say that it was so Machiavellian that we intentionally put people over there over whom we had no jurisdiction in order to permit them, but the proof is in the pudding, and indeed a lot of them participated in this and have not been prosecuted because of lack of jurisdiction. So, don't know. It's a scary problem.
Mark Bowden, you talked a lot in your writing about the expertise of the interrogator is the key. Through this outsourcing of interrogation, if not abuse or torture on some rare instances, I suppose, is this just revealing a kind of shortage in the American military of sophisticated interrogators who speak Arabic and who can actually fulfill this role that you say is really the key to getting that information that can save lives without treading dangerously into that line of abuse or torture?
I do think it reflects that. Often in the military, what happens is that especially non-commissioned soldiers with a great deal of experience can make more money and make a better living by leaving the service and taking jobs as private contractors. What you get with these private contractors, for the most part, as far as I understand it, is that they generally are fairly well-trained and fairly sophisticated practitioners, but what you lose completely is command and control. And I think that, you know, when we make a kind of a deal with the devil when we, you know, start expanding into this realm of private contracting, and I do think one of the motivations for doing so is that it does give more leeway because you have groups that are functioning outside of the normal chain of command.
Okay.
Julie, could I make a point here, too, which
Absolutely.
Is that some of this we need to remember isn't just interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is killing time and boredom and revenge and you know, sexual gratification and all kinds of things that really have nothing to do with interrogation.
Okay.
Exactly right.
Right.
And it goes to the point, Charles, that if you put one group of people in charge of another, you are going to get abuses. That is just a natural, sad fact of human nature. And without the strict chain of command, without you know, prosecution and punishment of those who overstep the rules, what you get is widespread abuse. It will happen every time.
All right. I want to bring in Nathaniel Fick. We don't have too much time left, but Nathaniel, bring this home for us. Talk to us about what is, in many ways, the truest experience of this, which is the experience on the ground. And that is the experience you have both in Afghanistan and Iraq. We can talk about clear lines, but you've seen them. What is your sense of where this debate is headed? Will this McCain amendment have any impact with the troops?
I think that most of the troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, most of the people I served with and I'm still in touch with, would support the McCain Amendment. I think most people are, at this point, very concerned with what is seen as a poor PR record by the United States in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And if the president were to veto the defense authorization bill over the McCain Amendment, the first use of a presidential veto in 5 years, it's as if we're doing the al-Qaeda propagandist work for them.
All right. Well, thank you. Nathaniel Fick, thank you very much. He is the author of One Bullet Away, The Making of a Marine Officer. And also thank you to John Hudson, president and dean of Franklin Pierce Law Center. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
And Mark Bowden, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly and author of Black Hawk Down. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Charles.
I'm Charles Sennett, and this is On Point. The indictment of former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay shook the GOP leadership in Washington. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty says the DeLay's indictment reveals something about politicians on both sides of the aisle.
Barely a week after Tom DeLay was indicted, I received a recorded phone message linking my congressman, New Hampshire Republican Charles Bass, to DeLay's nefarious doings. The voice was leering and male in a pre-indictment call. The voice was breathy and female, an earful of Viagra. The calls offer a foretaste of the 2006 elections as Democrats gear up to run against what Harry Reid, the Senate minority leader, calls the GOP's culture of corruption. That is worse news for the Democrats than for the Republicans. A negative referendum only postpones the evil day when the Democrats will have to take a positive program to the country. Going negative, moreover, seeds what a political scientist termed the supreme instrument of political power, the definition of alternatives to the GOP. For decades, conservatives have defined the alternatives: small government versus big government, weakness versus strength, permissiveness versus family values, relativism versus faith. Yet faith, value, strength, low taxes, and small government won't mitigate economic insecurity. Check the rise in America of a Paraguayan class structure of rich and poor and nothing in between, or manage the transition to a sustainable economy. better to lose an election running on issues that redefine the alternatives of politics than win on corruption, of which, when they were in power, the Democrats furnished specimens as odoriferous as the Republicans.
Jack Beatty is On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. He joins us now from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, you wouldn't advocate... Hi, how are you? You wouldn't advocate a negative referendum from the Democrats. But on the Republican side, we've been talking about a positive referendum, if we can call it that, from John McCain. What are your thoughts on the McCain Amendment and how this fits in this political terrain?
Well, I think that, for one thing, it does distinguish McCain. McCain has been cutting out a profile independent of the flow of charges of corruption in the Congress, and certainly independent of the Bush administration. And if the president does veto this bill, the Washington Post in today's editorial says that would be a confession of, quote, moral bankruptcy. So McCain has really put Bush in a pickle here. If he does veto the bill, this is going to say essentially the president endorses the idea that we should have torture. Very tough situation for Bush. Good one for McCain.
And the strength of McCain's argument is that moral voice. And we don't seem to hear that kind of moral voice brought to the arguments on the Democratic side. And it's puzzling why that would be. Certainly there are moral issues regarding poverty, regarding the ill-preparedness in the wake of Katrina. Why is it that the Democrats seem to not be able to get their hands around the moral issues of the day and to be able to explain them in ways that their voters can clearly understand?
Well, one of them is structural. They're the out party. Years ago, James McGregor Burns said that what we need in America is something like a shadow cabinet, so that the party, the out party, could have experts on the various fields, you know, defense, social policy, and so on, who would speak for the party on those things. We don't have that. Instead, it's every man and woman for himself. And the Democrats think they have found a great issue here in corruption. And here we have reports, the Washington Post today, election anxiety mounts among the GOP. The Hill, Capitol Hill newsletter, Republicans' 2006 Senate prospects sour, and they point out that strong candidates who are going to run against Robert Byrd in Virginia and against Kent Conrad in North Dakota have pulled out, and they've had similar problems in other places. And people are saying, well, the reason is this corruption issue is starting to take.
Mm. It's interesting that they just can't fashion a moral point on other issues like poverty.
It is, and they haven't found their voice on that. They've lost the politics of the common good.
All right, Jack, thank you very much. Jack Beatty is On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. He spoke with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. I'm Charles Sennett, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.